You're listening to Nights and Weekends. I'm your host, Lee Pacchia. I hope you're doing well out there, staying safe and sane and all of that. We have a really special episode for you this week. Our guest is Ken Lane. Ken has had a really interesting career writing for a digital media publication known as Gawker and running a politics site called Wonkette, among many other things. His latest project, however, is super cool. He's running something called Desert Oracle, a print and online publication that's like a regional magazine for people living out in the Mojave Desert. It has a podcast called Desert Oracle Radio that is one of my favorite things right now. If you haven't heard it yet, here's a taste.
Do you keep a list of your strange and unusual experiences? It's something I started doing about 10 years ago, and I'll tell you why. Because the kind of stuff you see that doesn't fit in, you tend to forget it. Now, how could we forget the most baffling moments of our lives, the most extraordinary events? Not just weird things in the sky, but the shocking moments of deja vu, the psychic communications. Like when you're dropping some stuff off at the thrift store and you notice a photograph at the bottom of the box and it's an old friend you haven't thought about or heard from in 25 years. And as you pluck the snapshot from the old box of now vintage clothes, your phone rings. It's the person in the picture. How do they even have your cell phone number? Well, I was just thinking about you, the long-lost friend will say. And just then, our old mutual friend texted me out of the blue, and she had your number. What a coincidence.
Ken, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the program.
You're welcome, Lee. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Man, I dig your show. It's like stepping into an episode of Twin Peaks where Jim Henson makes a cameo as a radio host. It's just wonderful.
Thank you. It's kind of how my life feels often out here.
Right,
like
on.
Twin Peaks with less green.
I dig it. I want to talk about the show, but I'd like to get a little bit of background at the start, if I could. Where'd you grow up?
New Orleans, born and raised.
Okay, and what did mom and dad do?
They were working class. My dad was in the Air Force out of high school, and both my mom and dad worked for NASA on the moonshot. We lived in Texas for that. And then when I was older, they had a business in California, which I worked for a number of years in my youth.
You started out as a journalist in Southern California, from where you headed on to what looks like, an incredible adventure in Eastern Europe. Why did you head out there?
So I was a reporter at a afternoon daily in Oceanside, California, which was fantastic. It was just crime and corruption, dirty cops and police brutality, Marines fighting with motorcycle chains on Hill Street downtown. And so it was this great life, but I kept seeing these pictures come across the wire, you know, back before everything went right onto computer terminals, your photos that would go to layout and be on your newspaper would print out in the three primary colors off of wire machines. And these pictures were coming off of everything going on in Europe starting in 89, you know, the Berlin Wall coming down, the protests and collapse of the government in Poland. And then like dominoes, it was all happening. And I thought, well, I can always come back to California, but you don't see empires crumble all the time. And these were places that previous to the Warsaw Pact countries all being overthrown, all their governments, it was very difficult for a Westerner to get into those countries and travel unless you had a real specific reason. So like a lot of people at the time, a lot of young people at the time, I headed out to see what might happen.
You did an awful lot there. I mean, you had, a number of gigs, which would take us an entire another episode to go through. But I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the Albanian comedy show that you worked on. And would it be possible to find it on YouTube? I've never seen any Albanian TV. I'm incredibly curious.
So I have never found this particular production online, and my friend Samet in Skopje, Macedonia, who directed this, I produced and wrote it with him. He hasn't been able to find any since he lost track of his VHS cassettes in the 90s. So it seems to be lost. But what it was a television movie in a couple of parts that was about the legendary Nasruddin. Now, Nasruddin is like this holy fool, and he had all these comical adventures with these morals and lessons and just classic stories that you'll find throughout the Muslim world. And because there'd been very little television drama done in the Albanian language, my buddy who I was living with down in Macedonia said, let's do this because there's a market and there's Albanian communities all over Europe and they're hungry for content. So we threw this thing together on a shoestring budget and we got this great comedian who had moved to London. He came back and did the Nasruddin character. And it was a costume piece and everything. It was fantastic.
I mean, I'm trying to imagine how challenging it would be to produce a type of show like this in the Balkans in the 1990s. It must have been uniquely challenging. I'm struggling for the
it
words.
It was wild. Yeah. I mean, it's the only shoot that I've ever been on that wasn't journalism, where there were military and police checkpoints and a bunch of rough-looking guys with AKs standing around, and you're hoping they're going to buy your story. I just remember being out in this little village in Kosovo, which is where we shot it, and it was really a medieval village that people still lived in, an agricultural village. And we're looking out at this kind of vista that we're going to shoot. And I remembered a documentary or maybe like a behind the scenes article or something where Steven Spielberg was talking about shooting Raiders of the Lost Ark. And they shot it in Tunisia. And so they're looking out over the old city, but there's television antennas everywhere sticking up like you'd have satellite dishes today. Mm-hmm. And that didn't look like their time, which was what, 1940 or something. So he had to pay people to run around and take down antennas because there was no CGI at the time. And I was looking out and there was just a sea of antennas. And I thought, well, we have no money. We could offer to, pay somebody. And my partner on it says, look, everybody's going to want to be in this. So we'll just say, if you take down your antenna, you can be in a crowd scene. So we sat up there having lunch and drinking hot tea out of a samovar, smoking cigarettes and just watching as one aerial after another. Now, granted, there were only about a dozen in this town. It wasn't a whole city scene, but that was one of the moments when I thought, well, newspaper work didn't really prepare me for this, but I guess other things did.
Yeah, video production, it's a unique experience if you haven't done it before. It throws a lot of life's challenges at you really quickly in a high-stress situation. I think it's great training. So then after your stint in Eastern Europe, you came back to the States, and after a couple of online journalism projects, you land at Gawker. During Gawker's growth years, and some would say the golden period for Gawker, how would you characterize your time at that publication?
I was there on and off for the whole thing, minus about the first 18 months, I guess. Nick Denton, who started Gawker, I met him through mutual friends, journalism friends in Budapest. He was at the Financial Times at the time, and I was at the Budapest Business Journal, which was a local business paper. We had a chain of them. We had one in Warsaw, one in Prague, but the original and the biggest one was in Budapest. Mm-hmm. And Nick is half Hungarian, so he could speak the language, and he, like a lot of us, was chasing revolutions, you know, like, oh, what's going on here? And he had an end there, so he went. But while he was there, he got the Silicon Valley bug. It turned out that I had gone to San Francisco along with another mutual friend, editor, who knew Nick pretty well from Budapest. And so we met up after I had started this thing called tabloid.net in San Francisco, and Nick was covering Silicon Valley for the FT, Financial Times. And Nick wanted to start some kind of thing, and he liked what we were doing. And so he offered us $50,000 for this thing we'd been doing for 2 years. And I was, you know, outraged and offended that he would offer so little for this thing that made no money. You know, we were in the Bay Area in the first internet boom. We thought it should be at least $100,000. So He said, all right, fine, you're not going to do it. And he started his own thing in New York. He moved to New York shortly thereafter and started Gawker and Gizmodo. And then when I had my first kid, I needed money. So I called him. I'm like, Nick, what do you got? He's like, well, why don't you do that thing that you did before and do it for me? And so I did that with Corey Sika, who's now styles editor at the New York Times, who was an early Gawker editor, and we worked on a bunch of stuff together. So that's kind of how the Gawker entered and left my life several times. So I'd work there for a while, leave, do something else. And then I ended up doing their politics site in DC for a half dozen years. That was longest stint.
Wonkette, which I always forget was a Gawker property at one time, but you actually went to go lead it as it spun off. And I believe at one point you owned it.
I did. I was publisher.
How is it like working for Wonkette?
It was, that had not been my dream, I guess, job. It was fun. It was interesting. I got to cover presidential campaigns and travel around and all kinds of crazy stuff, like the Tea Party movement. You know, we were right there for that. And a lot of the colorful characters who sort of paved the way for our current politics, people like Sarah Palin, who went on a campaign to get us shut down. We ended up going to war with Papa John himself at one point. So it was good training for everything that has happened since 2016, when like all the old rules of politics stopped working.
Right. It's kind of like an uncomfortable side benefit to a gig in political journalism. You kind of get a feel for what the world's going to look like 18 months ahead of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So now you're working on something called Desert Oracle, which I just love. It's one of my favorite new podcasts that is in my life. I really don't want to mischaracterize it at all. So could you please do the heavy lift here and tell us exactly what Desert Oracle is?
Sure. About 10 years ago, in fact, it was just about exactly 10 years ago, I came up with this idea for a desert radio show. I've lived in the desert for much of my life, And I've been in the Mojave Desert full time for a dozen years now and have lived in pretty much all the other ones, the Great Basin, the Sonoran, the Colorado Desert. I haven't lived in Utah and like slick rock country, although I've spent a lot of time out there. And that's what I love. You know, I love being out in the middle of nowhere. I love the weird creatures and extremes of weather and geography. And I love all the weird people and folklore. So I thought, well, maybe there's a way to kind of put this stuff together into a kind of virtual world that you can listen to in the case of the radio show. I ended up not doing the radio show until 2017 because that wasn't my strong point experience wise. So since I'd come out of print and publishing and everything else, I said, you know, I'll do a regional magazine. So I started that in 2015, Desert Oracles, a little yellow book. And it was at the right time. I mean, it's got a cult audience. It barely, you know, pays the bills, but it pays the bills. So I'm happy with that. And once the little book was out there, and you can subscribe or you can buy it at desert bookstores and little shops where they have all the odd desert things, or the hipster desert shops that are a new thing because the desert became a destination at that same time, like around 16. So the radio show, the idea is, a while back, if you were driving through the American desert, going through the AM dial, you'd come across these weird late night shows. And in that environment, on a dark two lane, maybe you're driving out because you're going to go camping somewhere, or maybe you're just kind of an odd character who gets in the car and drives for hours in the middle of the desert for the hell of it, which I've always found very meditative and satisfying. And you'd come across these things and there'd be some announcer somewhere and all these odd characters are calling in and talking about UFOs and monsters in the desert and underground bases, just all this wonderful, wild, folkloric conspiracy stuff. And I just love that stuff. And I thought, maybe if you tighten that into kind of a half hour kind of thing, rather than the meandering 4 hours of talk radio where you might have a few great moments like that. But, you know, if you've ever listened to talk radio, a lot of it's dull. Mm-hmm. So kind of compress it and have a way to kind of get to that desert highway in the middle of the night just by listening to the show. So that was the goal of it.
Yeah, it's extremely atmospheric, the radio show, and it definitely has a Lynchian vibe, which I certainly appreciate, and I suspect a lot of your fan base does. As for the print aspect of the project, it almost looks like a throwback to the great alt-weekly culture of the 80s and 90s. You actually focus on print subscription. Why is that? Isn't that incredibly expensive in 2020?
Not really. It's my kind of theory about the different mediums you can use for creative projects is that the things that everybody ignores, that's the stuff that you should look at because it's kind of easy to break in. So I live in a place where we don't have any local media to speak of, except for that real rarity that's left after all the Cumulus Clear Channel consolidation at the beginning of this century. We actually have a mom and pop station in Joshua Tree that has local news, and it's a music station, but they have local news in the morning. They play local news several times a day throughout the day. And so I was able, you know, to go in there and do the radio show. But otherwise we don't really have, you know, local and regional media. So much of the U.S. now, we don't have any of that. And that stuff gives a place its identity. You think back to, say, like Mike Royko in Chicago, or Jimmy Breslin in New York, you know, these characters that come to be human representations of their readership, of their audience. And so that's what I wanted to do, because in a place that's as spread out as the area that I live in, the high desert, where we have 40,000 people spread over like 100+ miles, there's not a easy way to have a sense of community. But we have a lot of interesting people out here, from just people who moved out because they're desert rats and oddballs, people who've always lived here, artists, musicians, eccentrics of all kinds. We've got lots of monasteries, Zen monasteries, yoga camps, witches, you know, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought, if there's a little something that you can hold that makes you feel like, you know, you're home, the way that people who are probably 30 and under don't remember, but like, if you were going to move somewhere in the past, you'd call the newspaper and order a couple of newspapers and they'd mail them to you. Or the Chamber of Commerce would mail you a couple of newspapers and you could get a sense of what was going on in the town. You know, mm-hmm. There'd be help wanted ads. You'd see the entertainment listings. You'd see the kind of weird stuff that shows up in the local news and the features and everything. So I think print's valuable, but print loses a lot of its value when it's cookie cutter stuff like Gannett papers, where they look the same everywhere and they just, you know, they don't have any commitment to the place. Accounting calls, they need to get rid of 300 people. They get rid of 300 people on a spreadsheet. They don't care who those people are on the ground and, you know, places where, say, out west where Gannett has papers, Palm Springs, Phoenix, Reno, et cetera.
I'm here with Ken Lane from Desert Oracle. More after the break. Here with Ken Lane. Ken, I want to go back and talk a little bit about Gawker, if we could. You were there while it was ramping up, as you said in the previous block. You were there pretty much for the entire duration. Looking back, how do you think about Gawker and what happened to it?
I think that it ran its course. That's sort of how I see it. Now, when it was really building up and becoming this big media business of its own, I was independent at that point because they'd farmed off Wonkette to me. This was in 2008, that recession, and their advertising people hated Wonkette because it was Alex Perrine and I ran it for a while. Perrine's is great. Writer, he's sure. A New Republic.
Sure. It must have brought in a ton of page views.
It brought in a ton of page views, but the ad people hated it because they didn't like the politics. Okay. And that was a time when things have kind of, you know, the tables have turned a bit, and now people are allowed to be, I don't know, progressive or liberal or something. And some of these things, they really didn't want you doing that. It was okay if you were conservative, you know, for, you know, on the business side of things, but they didn't like the other side. And so the advertising guy at Gawker just really disliked the site and he didn't want to sell it. In fact, I don't think he liked Gawker much either. What he really liked were the ones where you could sell computer equipment like Gizmodo. Mm-hmm. Which makes sense, obviously, you know, because Gizmodo was all affiliate marketing. You click through, you buy the new iPhone through the click, and there's real money goes to Gawker Media. So I came back in 2013 and 14 for a year. And that was after the Hulk Hogan incident. Mm-hmm. And if you know, for listeners who hopefully didn't follow this because it's so dumb. Hulk Hogan was a, I guess he's still alive, a wrestler, a celebrity, one of the, you know, fake wrestlers from the TV. And he had a following. And a video was posted of, I believe it was Hulk Hogan having sex with his friend's wife or right. something.
Bubba the Love Sponge. I think he's a radio host in the Tampa area.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah. Yes, yes, that rings a bell. A sad bell, but the bell's ringing. And a mysterious figure appeared and offered to Mr. Hulk or Hogan, if that is his real name, that they would pay his legal expenses to sue specifically Gawker for posting a few seconds of this clip, even though the clip had been all over the place and all over internet forums and everything else. They specifically wanted to go after Gawker. And because Hulk Hogan lives in Florida, a state famous for its weird, weird judges and its bizarre little court fiefdoms, it was more appealing to this secret legal fees benefactor that Florida would be where the trial would be. Mm-hmm. So Gawker was sued for violating Mr. Hogan's privacy. And everybody thought nothing would happen because he's a public figure. He made the tape. Apparently he or his one of the people involved in having the sex distributed the tape. But the person who was paying the legal bills was Peter Thiel, the Facebook PayPal billionaire. And he was mad at Nick because a Gawker site called ValleyWag had repeated the well-known fact that Peter Thiel was supporting policies that were against gay people and gay rights, and he himself was gay. That was the logic of mentioning this. And so it was like a 10-year revenge plot, which if you got the money, you know, why not? So Gawker ended up going bankrupt. I had left by then. I went to a Christmas party in New York and everybody was living it up and they rented a whole hotel in Tribeca and got, you know, flew all the out of towners like myself into town.
I was at that party.
You were at that party?
Yeah, I spoke to Alex Perrine right when I was leaving.
Jesus God.
Funny that we didn't bump into each other.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was like the last moment before everything fell off the cliff.
Pretty much. It was in the next 6 months. I gave my notice about 30 days after that. I had a offer to do a little conservation, like a wilderness conservation newsletter from someone I knew up in the Bay Area. It was just a short-term thing, but it gave me an excuse. You know, I'd get a little money. And I felt like it was over. You know, it was Gawker was a cultural force. People tell me all the time, I grew up reading Gawker. I grew up reading this or that or the video game site. I love the comments. You know, I knew all the writers.
It trained a generation of some of the best writers in the country. I mean, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills sometimes because people don't give it what I feel is it should be its due.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's hard to look at what's happening across the media landscape and not point back to Gawker's demise as somehow emblematic of all the horrible stuff that happened to digital media companies in the last 10 years. I mean, the ability for billionaires and their lawyers to just nuke a mid-sized publication from orbit like it was nothing, I feel like it's a problem in our society that people don't fully appreciate.
It's true. And the journalists and media people throw around the phrase chilling effect, I think, too much. But this really did have an impact, because what had previously been unthinkable, which is that you could sue a publication out of existence when the publication did not commit any offense the way that, say, the National Enquirer would get sued in the 80s, because they'd make stuff up. You know, they'd say whatever. I don't even want to say the celebrity names, because they might still have lawyers looking to get people for mentioning it. But they'd have stories about people, like well-known celebrities, and they weren't true. And they'd get sued, and they took big hits. What Gawker did was, to my mind, poor taste, not of the spirit of Gawker, which was supposed to be smart and cover the media and be intelligent about things and not be, you know, posting a sex video of a television wrestler from the 1980s. I mean, like, that's not even part of modern culture at that time. So it was stupid. Mm-hmm. But it was not anything that previously would have resulted in a judgment that would bankrupt a publication. So it's, and I think of some of the right, you know, almost all the good people out of Gawker are still working. I'm thinking of people like Katie Weavers at New York Times, you know, Corey Sika, styles mm-hmm. editor at New York Times, Anna Merlin is at Vice now and has written a book. Anna Holmes. I was just surrounded by people. Hamilton Nolan, who ended up kind of single-handedly unionizing East Coast media. So it produced a lot of good people. Most of them are still young in the kind of prime of their careers. And I'm glad it's remembered fondly, and I'm glad that it mostly is remembered for all this talent that came out of it, and not the notoriety that ended it.
Want to pivot back and just touch kind of briefly on Wonkette. You know, we spoke to Professor David Karp in a previous program. He's a professor at the intersection of politics and media. And we were talking about the breakdown of this kind of standard we've had in American journalism for the last, I don't know, 50, 60 years about neutral objectivity should kind of be the standard of the publication you write for. Everyone seems to be of the opinion that that standard is somewhat breaking down. People can reasonably diverge on how much and how quickly it's breaking down, but I think it's safe to say that the tide is starting to turn on this.
Yeah.
Do you think the ad people that you referenced before would look at something like Wonkette more favorably in coming months and years, or is the media business still one in which you can have an overtly right-wing publication and make a profit?
Well,
but you can't do it if you're left of the dial.
Here's the thing. The only right-wing media that makes a profit is broadcast, not print or text on a screen.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Politics stuff has always needed benefactors in print. So you look at magazines like New Republic or National Review. I'm just mixing them up, you know, that not dividing them by approach politically. Because what do you sell? You know, what you're selling is ideas. So they're almost always backed by some sort of philanthropic organization. For instance, Reason. You know, my friend Matt Welch was editor of Reason for a long time, and he still works there. Reason is funded by a foundation. They've got some little ads in the back. They make a little from subscriptions, but not enough for offices in Washington, D.C. and all this stuff. And this has long been the case with any kind of partisan political thing. Once the Fairness Doctrine went in the 1980s on radio and on television as well, then you could do whatever. You didn't have to follow that objectivity or that appearance of objectivity anymore. And that's when the Limbaughs and all his imitators were able to sweep through and reach the older baby boomer, you know, white guys who were driving around all day in their service trucks or whatever, or pretending they were driving around in trucks that they were actually, you know, accountants in the city or whatever. And I think the way that digital media is now is hugely influenced by what Gawker was done. I mean, we kind of made the templates for all that stuff, that you would say what's on your mind, you'd call a crook a crook. You know, it's more like an old 30s, 40s kind of approach to journalism, reporting, newspapering, than what it became when it professionalized in the 60s and 70s, and they started asking people for college degrees to go in and write cop stories. So the return of tone, I think, is kind of a cyclical thing. But with the advertising disappearing, I mean, even if you met some perfect standard that doesn't exist, that didn't offend any advertiser, where's the advertising? You know, so like you were at Bloomberg, and Bloomberg's model is subscriptions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they make some money on the radio stations. I mean, now I listen to Bloomberg radio all the time because I've got satellite in the car and I like business news. I find business news much more to the point than general news for a general audience. And there's some ads and stuff, but basically the ad is for the Bloomberg terminal, right?
Right.
They want subscriptions. They want people to rely on it. And so I really think that subscription models are, as TV has already proven, are the most effective way in the future. The problem is everybody wants in on it, and people only have so many pennies you can squeeze out of them. So you can either be kind of a cult small audience thing like what I do, or you can be some also ran like, what was that mess that Meg Whitman was involved in, the streaming 3 minutes?
Quibi.
Yeah, Quibi. Yeah. Quibi. My brain has already pronounced it or replaced it with like QAnon or something, just some weird Q thing. So there's going to be a lot of big failures like that. And everything else is like hanging on. Like Vice is getting wiped out. You know, every time you hear about Vice, they've laid off another 100 people. Eventually there's not 100 people to lay off.
No, it's certainly tough times in the American media business. When we come back from the break, I want to kind of zoom out 35,000 feet and talk about everything else in our society that's melting down in addition to American digital media. Ken Lane is with us, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Forest Ranger Betty White here, lending a hand to my dear friend Smokey Bear, because for 75 years, he's only said,
"Only you can prevent wildfires."
But there's a lot more to say. Like, if you park your car on tall, dry grass, the hot exhaust pipe can start a wildfire. So be careful out there. Go to SmokeyBear.com to learn more about wildfire prevention. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
And we're back. So moving away from the carnage in American digital media, Ken, our society faces three crises front and center. The COVID-19 pandemic, of course, the economic downturn, which is taking everything down with it, and this great reckoning, this great social unrest across the country over police misconduct and systemic racism. I like how you managed to touch on all three in a recent episode of the Desert Oracle podcast called If It's Broke, Fix It. Listeners, you should check out all of Ken's work on your podcast platform of choice, but this one in particular. Ken, you really leaned on the local politics angle.
Having seen the local sheriff's deputies habitually mistreat the peaceful young people drawn to Aspen's beauty and sense of community, these reformers aim to take over every aspect of local government, city and county political offices, including coroner, mayor, supervisors, and of course the sheriff's department. And they did not simply propose fresh faces, some minor reforms. They proposed, with intense community input and clarity, completely remaking the institutions that no longer serve the people.
Can you talk to me a little bit about how people in your neck of the woods view what's happening now?
Sure. We are all feeling a disenchantment with the ability of national politics or any sort of international bodies, which have taken, you know, nearly as many hits as media in the last few years. We're feeling, whether we identify as liberal or conservative or independent, that a lot of it's smoke and mirrors, and none of us are really doing much better, and a handful of people are doing much, much better. And to see this sort of become a reality that you can even discuss in public, you know, I went to Occupy 9 years ago, because I've been having this stuff on my mind. I'd written a novel about people escaping the 2008 recession and kind of setting up their own sort of free communities, making use of what had been abandoned by, you know, Lehman Brothers went down in the Western Mojave in a big housing tract north of Victorville, an hour and a half past LA. We have a saying in Southern California, drive until you qualify. So if you have a job in that area and you want to own a house, you just get in the car and keep driving until you finally get to a place, you know, some exurb where the houses are affordable and they'll give you a loan. So when Occupy happened, just talking about the stuff that Occupy was about, which was distribution of income, social services, all these things being redlined. A lot of people, even in the millennial journalism generation, didn't want to, you know, it's like, oh, you know, we don't want to get ID'd with the socialist kind of thing, because that's a kiss of death, you know, in polite society. You can't talk about that. And now here we are 9 years later, and it's mainstream politics. And it's mainstream politics on both sides. Everybody's like, give stuff away, we better, because just like in the New Deal, you know, the New Deal wasn't because FDR was some loving, you know, Christ consciousness figure who decided to redistribute wealth. They saw what was going on. They saw what happened in Russia just a decade plus before. And mm-hmm. They saw that it was just a few sparks away from happening here. And not only would they not be collecting wealth at that level, but they might end up in gulags or something. You don't know. So now we're in that same place. But it's all very slow. It's all very corrupted. It's still very much based on optics. And then down on the ground, these little local races, people are figuring out, that's how you stop the police force that's somehow driving Pentagon tanks around on top of people in, you know, towns of 30,000. It's like, why are they getting these? Because a local police department keeps saying yes, and a local city council or a local county supervisors keep saying yes. And these races are decided, especially in small towns like where I am, by handfuls of votes. So in mm-hmm. Harris County, Houston area, in 2018, 17 black women, mostly lawyers who worked as defense attorneys, ran for judgeships and won. And they just like wiped out a whole generation of male white judges, including a lot of, you know, Democrats, liberals on paper, because that was how they saw that they could end the cash bail crisis, which is that if you don't have money, that's when they get you, and you have a bunch, and then you need a bunch of money to get out on bail because of things that a well-off white person doesn't have to even be taken in for. You know, if you get pulled over in a nice part of Pasadena or something for a DUI, well, yeah, they're going to take you in, but then they'll release you. If you're a kid from a poor neighborhood, you don't have any money, you don't have relatives that have money, you don't have a credit card you can put bail on, you sit in jail. So we got people dying of COVID for like DUIs because they can't come up with $25,000 bail. So, and these judge races in Houston and Harris County, these were decided often by handfuls of votes, even though it's the fifth biggest metro area in the country, fifth or fourth. It might be going on fourth now. So in small towns like this, we can do that very easily. And there's all kinds of things, you know, you like a friend of mine, Eric Spiegelman in LA, he's taxi commissioner. And we were talking the other day on text messages, and he's going through the budget that he has the authority to act on. And he finds this huge chunk of money that's going to LAPD out of the taxi commissioner's budget. And
really?
Yeah. And it's just, you know, and it's everywhere you look, the libraries, the school districts, the water districts.
Is there anything you can do about that line item, or is it, are his hands tied?
Yeah, I don't want to give it away because he's going to do something about it. And I want him to get attention for it. It hasn't been done yet. But this is what's happening. People in local roles, community roles, part-time things, you know, you can be on the water board. They'll give you like, I don't know, $13,000-$14,000 a year up here. You got to show up to one meeting a month and, you know, read the minutes and approve things. And
not a bad gig.
It's not a bad gig. No, not in a place where cost of living is very low, you know, relative to the big cities. And you then have your hands on the purse strings and you get to look at things. And for the first time, people are looking at budgets and saying, Jesus Christ, everything goes to the cops, nothing to the libraries, nothing to the Head Start. The Head Start gets federal money, but local money would make the difference between it being everywhere for everyone who needs it. And all it takes is a vote, you know? A vote in a little conference room in some place most people drive by their whole life where they live and not even know what goes on there. And this is how you redistribute resources on a very, very local level. And it has a huge impact and it doesn't cost anything to run.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we're starting to see that conversation start to happen in certainly the New York City area. But as I was doing an interview with Ellie Mistel that we're going to publish later today, talking about what needs to happen for change. Ellie's fantastic. Absolutely love the guy. But I was talking to him about, look, this is hard. You know, these budgets have been calcified for decades. There are unions in the mix that really have their act together. I mean, no one has been more effective on the labor front than police unions. It's hard to know how money is getting spent and effectively what needs to happen here to improve society is that your average Joe Sixpack voter is going to need to pay attention to these issues, and newly elected people who ideally are not professional politicians are now going to have to, on day one, roll up their sleeves and dive into the budget process for local law enforcement, which is a jump that needs to be made.
It's not, and it's not that daunting because everybody has to balance their own budget. You know, you got to figure out how you're going to get through the month and how you're going to distribute your resources and take care of your kids and make your rent or house payment and everything. And it's real simple. And when I was a newspaper reporter, this was something that they really drilled into us early. It's like, get the budget, find the big numbers. That's where the stories are. If you come in and to say a school board, you go to a school board, there's really not much more to decide on. You might have some occasional disciplinary actions. You might be asked to come up with an alternative for the Halloween festival with social distancing or whatever, but it's really all about the budget. And like Minneapolis proved, what did it take? About 8 days to come up with a veto-proof majority vote to start taking apart the police department that has caused so much pain and death and anxiety for people day to day for decades and decades. And it's just a number on a budget, and it just takes a majority. So it's one of those things that's, like when Saul is on the road to Damascus and he sees his UFO in the desert and has his conversion experience to Christianity and everything, and it blinds them, right? It's like it causes cataracts or something. And the way they describe it in the Bible is in Acts is the scales fell away from his eyes. And now we use that to describe this sort of amazing moment when you just kind of like wipe your eyes and you can see it's clear now. That's where all the money went. Okay, well, maybe you can't change Congress and the White House from Joshua Tree, California, Woodstock, New York, wherever the hell you are. But you can sure change what's going on here. When I was covering education, there was a semi-rural school district in San Diego County, Vista, a little town called Vista, north of the city of San Diego. And they had a group of conservative Christians who decided they were going to run and they were going to go in and get rid of all the science books, So I want to, argue with Genesis. And they did this, and it started a national revolution in the early 90s of activist takeovers of school boards. Now, their interest wasn't really financial. Their interest was dogmatic, but they showed you could do it. And I think it's a lesson that until just now has often been lost on progressive and left-leaning people and communities, because, sometimes there's things that are just too big to even understand how day-to-day life would be if those tables were turned. But we're in a special time now, I think, where no matter who you are politically or economically or something, you know in your heart now that everything's up for grabs.
So we'll pencil you in as an optimist, Ken.
Oh, I'm an optimist. I'm optimistic about climate change. California is going to hit their 50% renewables goal several years early. We've made every other goal several years early. A lot of things that people said could never happen are already happening. And while we're people in the world, there's always things going on. There's tough times and wars and famine and pestilence and cats and dogs living together and everything. But it feels like, especially seeing what the kids are doing, it feels like, everybody is aware of the possibilities.
Ken, I've laid a lot of heavy stuff on you for this episode, but maybe we can close on something lighter and more positive. You have a special episode coming up for Desert Oracle number 100, and it sounds like you're going to do it at probably one of my favorite concert venues in the country, Pappy and Harriet's, a honky tonk bar up in the I don't know, it's a desert plateau. I don't know what I would call it. But can you tell us a little bit about what you have planned for this episode?
Yeah, it's the they call it the best honky tonk this side of the Mississippi, and because I just got word, like right before I spoke to you, well, you can have the scoop on this. So we were gonna do it outside on the street on Main Street, which is a dirt street in the middle of Pioneertown. Pioneertown was built as a Western movie set in the 1940s for the likes of Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, et cetera, so they could do their movies and TV shows and have homes, ranch houses around this area and ride their horses to work, which I think is just the most magnificent idea. And so they did it for a while, and until kind of the fading out of the Western era, it was very busy for that. Since then, it's turned into a kind of high desert tourist town. Pappy and Harriet's has great acts. You see all kinds of up and coming things. Big people stop in and play sometimes. Robert Plant likes to hang out around here. He'll come in and sing, you know, Elvis songs with the house band on Sundays. Paul McCartney's been there. Lucinda Williams played when they opened up the outside stage when they expanded. So that's where we are doing it as an official, because there's still some county issues with like being outside with booze and whatever. We're doing it on the outside outdoor concert stage at Pappy's, which is just like out the big doors. You can still go in and eat in Pappy's, but we're doing a live show, an hour long episode with guests and live music and opening music acts. It's going to be Friday, July 17th at sundown, doors at 6, I believe. And we're going to be broadcasting it in Pioneer Town, which is basically this bowl of rocks up over the high desert all by itself. So if you or anyone listening, if you're up here, we're kind of opening up to visitors again. It should be a fun night. And it's, yeah, somehow we've done 100 episodes of this thing, and somehow I've written every one of them.
Awesome. I'm excited for you. I have a special fondness for Pappy and Harriet's. We did my wife's 40th back in 2019 there. We saw Chromatics, if you can believe it.
Chromatics.
Right out in the desert. It was spectacular.
Oh, I so dearly wanted to go to that show. You know, that I've gotten
it was
into
so,
them.
So good.
Out of Twin Peaks season 3, you know, with Johnny, what's his name, who produces them. I heard that was a great show. Well, you know, I guess I wasn't at that one, but that was a big event up here.
Regardless, it's a great place, man. Ken Lane from Desert Oracle, thank you so much for your time today, sir. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you, Lee. I did too.
And that's our show. We are produced by Connor Lynch. As always, if you like what you heard, please subscribe to the show. We'd love it if you could give us a good review, or even better, help sponsor the program through the link in the heading. If you have any comments, guest or topic suggestions, or just want to tee off, please feel free to hit me up at lee@niteswknds.com. One more time, that's lee@niteswknds.com. See you next time.